Please be seated.
If you'll permit me to say this, we didn't want to proceed without our materials on the bench. Some members of the bar think we're winging it all the time. So in any event, the clerk will call the docket.
My name is Scott Siegel, and I have the absolute pleasure to introduce to your honors Rachel Mattis with the American University Immigrant Justice Clinic. She is going to be appearing before this court arguing the case of the appellant under my supervision pursuant to this court's granting our motion for her to practice as a third-year practice student.
All right. Welcome to the court.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Rachel Mattis, and I'm here today on behalf of the appellant, Michael Zimene. This case is about whether there is a reasonable probability that but for Mr. Zimene's counsel's unprofessional errors, the result of the proceeding would have been different. And when we look at a plea bargain, the question we're asking is whether a rational defendant in similarly situated circumstances would have rejected that plea.
Counsel, before you go down that road, help me understand why habeas is applicable under the present status of this gentleman.
Mr. Zimene filed for his habeas while he was still serving his suspended sentence. So under the statute, he was eligible at that time. Does that answer your question?
Well, I was more particularly interested in what the immigration people
said. Oh, okay. Yes, Your Honor. So Mr. Zimene has been ordered deported, and so he has suffered the deportation consequences that Padilla considers appropriate for an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. So withholding of removal, although he does currently remain in the United States, means that he does have an order of deportation. He's subject to deportation to a third country at any time and to his native country if the circumstances change there. The only reason he's able to remain here at this time is because an immigration judge has found at the moment that it's more likely than not that he faces severe persecution or death if he's returned to his home country.
All right, thank you.
So, Your Honors, the Fairfax County Circuit Court erred because it denied my client's habeas petition because he failed to make a claim of innocence or put forth a defense that he would have used at trial, and that is not the standard. The standard is whether there's a reasonable probability that the outcome of the proceeding would have been different. And so what we look to here is whether a rational defendant in similarly situated circumstances, had he been afforded effective counsel, would have rejected that plea. And that comes from the Padilla case, which is central here. So for Mr. Zimene, who's been a longtime lawful permanent resident of this country, who immigrated here as a child, whose family is here and who faces persecution or death, we're looking at whether that individual would have rejected a plea in this circumstance. The plea he agreed to was a 365-day suspended sentence for a petty larceny conviction of $33. The only reason that this is causing him immigration consequences is because of the length of the sentence. So had it been a 364-day sentence, he would not have suffered immigration consequences, and his attorney had an obligation to inform him of those consequences as effective counsel.
Well, counsel, let me ask you this. You can't seem to, I don't think you can think about this case since you talk about prejudice prong on this. And what does he have to prove to show he's been prejudiced? You've already said that if counsel had told him the consequences, the immigration consequences, he would not have pled guilty to the charge that he pled guilty to. He has not claimed that if he'd gone to trial, he'd be innocent, nor has he claimed that if he had rejected that plea agreement, he could have either gotten a better plea agreement from the Commonwealth or a better outcome from the trial court if he'd just gone and pled straight up, or anything else that would be a consequence that would be not prejudicial to him. Don't you have to have something about that in there?
So the Fourth Circuit and other courts look at the objective circumstances of the situation to determine whether there's prejudice has been met, and what the circumstances are here, because he only needed this small difference. Had his attorney been an effective advocate, and attorneys across the country and here in Virginia in the circuit courts that are disclosing the immigration consequences are having sentences modified. So in the Arlington Circuit Court in Sharma, there was a situation with a two-year sentence that that court modified to a 360-day sentence because of the immigration consequences.
Now, just because you have some anecdotal evidence about these kind of things happening, is that all you need to have for to show prejudice?
Your Honor, in this, the prejudicial issue here is...
In other words, I guess my point is, don't you have to have something to say that, well, this trial judge never gives anybody a year if they know there's an immigration consequence, or this Commonwealth attorney would always reduce to 364 days if it's an immigration consequence. But you don't have any of that in the plea.
Your Honor, I think requiring that amount of evidence is basically impractical in the situation to ask a prosecutor to state that had he known he would have...
Well, counsel, let me ask you, in that regard, this gentleman had nothing to lose, did he? Wasn't he prejudiced by not allowing him the opportunity to say 365 days is the worst I can get, and therefore I'm probably better off going on to trial?
Yes, he was prejudiced by not having the opportunity to go on to trial or to negotiate an alternate plea, and that's the situation here. So courts are...
That was a friendly question.
I appreciate it. So, yes, I mean, that was what, you know, makes him prejudiced, because he didn't have that opportunity to either negotiate an alternate plea or to go on to trial. And courts are recognizing that for non-citizens with close ties to the United States, that factor is of utmost importance, pretty much irregardless of how strong the case might be against the individual. Now, here, again, because the circumstances... Because what he needed was so little, that there might have been a strong case is even less relevant. But in cases where the evidence is very strong against the defendant, when they're a non-citizen, lawful permanent resident with close ties to the United States, the rational calculus for them is very different than it would be for a United States citizen whose objective might be to avoid jail time, whereas here the objective is going to be to stay in the United States, and that might mean going to jail. It might mean taking some kind of alternative circumstance. It might mean pleading to additional charges, and Padilla specifically talks about a defense attorney's obligation to creatively plea bargain. So, for example, in this case, there were some charges that were dropped. Those charges are not aggravated felonies, so it would have been better off and actually possible to still achieve a 365-day suspended sentence by combining time from one of those charges and the petty larceny. That circumstance would not have rendered him deportable. So his attorney actually made him worse off, potentially, by having those charges dropped in exchange for this plea.
Let me ask you this, counsel. If you're correct, does this actually open the door and have a floodgate of people now who are facing immigration consequences who didn't like the result they got?
No, Your Honor. Again,
creative plea bargaining could happen in any kind of case, but it doesn't necessarily have to happen. Just because it's a possibility, is that enough to show prejudice?
No, that's one option. Like, as he's also insisted that he would have gone to trial, I don't think this opens the door to a vast amount of people. This is just looking at the Supreme Court's case in Padilla, which is saying for non-citizens, they deserve advice about the clear consequences of their deportation consequences of conviction, or about the... If the consequences aren't clear, then they at least are to be advised that there might be immigration consequences. And so when individuals get neither of those, and it's clear that a rational defendant in those circumstances wouldn't have accepted the plea, then that's the opportunity that we're looking at for people like this.
Well, if we agreed that the trial court used the wrong standard, why would we not send it back for an evidentiary hearing? I know you said that kind of evidence would be difficult to amass in your judgment, but why would that not be at least an option?
That's certainly an option. We believe that there's enough information here just based on the objective circumstances to meet the prejudice prong under the standard. However, if this court feels that additional evidence would be necessary to make that determination of what a rational defendant would do in that circumstance, we would be happy to have it remanded to be able to have that hearing.
Well, counsel, if it was remanded, and for example, all of the outcomes of criminal cases in Fairfax are public record and would be admissible in a Fairfax proceeding. Turns out that no person who has had a single petty larceny charge has ever received the full sentence of 365 days in jail. That would show prejudice, would it not?
Yes, that would.
So there would be a benefit to your client from it going back for an evidentiary hearing.
Yes, we would certainly be happy for it to go back for an evidentiary hearing. As I mentioned, I think we feel that there's enough information based on what's been pledged just because of the situation that Mr. Zemeni is in, that there's really no circumstance that he would rationally have agreed to that plea, but we'd be happy to go back to the trial court for an evidentiary hearing to put that evidence on and look at those types of cases.
Well, is this the kind of a case where you might have to have an expert witness?
Potentially. I mean, I think it would be possible maybe not to get that specific prosecutor, but to get a prosecutor or a retired prosecutor who could talk about that, to get other defense attorneys could talk about the types of agreements they've made in similar cases.
This is one of those circumstances where the United States Supreme Court is too far removed from the General District Court to understand how things actually work. And I think the burden is unworkable, but it is a burden that is on the petitioner. And the truth, sentencing practices are such that the issue is not how many days you get, it's how many days are suspended, because the judges are holding time over a defendant for the purpose of controlling for future behavior. And so I don't know how you'd ever get the kind of evidence that you need to get to determine what a judge's likelihood would be that the sentence would be 364 days with all suspended, as opposed to 365 days with all suspended. I think your burden is just enormous.
I think that what we can look to for that are the cases that are in state courts in Virginia that are modifying sentences based on these. So there are judges that are taking that step. And I also think that Mr. Zemeni, because he would have insisted on going to trial, he doesn't have to show that he would have been innocent at trial. He just needs to demonstrate that it would have been rational to insist on going to trial, which he has done in his affidavit and looking at the objective circumstances here.
Now, are you familiar with the recent Fourth Circuit case, Omar Gharib versus Holder, where the Fourth Circuit said that a Virginia larceny conviction doesn't qualify?
I am, Your Honor.
So do you think you have any procedural relief in that regard? Or, for example, would this... Well, just answer that.
Sure. So because Mr. Zemeni has already been ordered deported as an aggravated felon, he would need to move to reopen his immigration case, which is not guaranteed. So that potentially could be an option, but it still doesn't take away what's already happened to him, even though perhaps if the immigration judge found that this, you know, fit in the same way, it might have been different if it happened in the future. But for him, he's already an aggravated felon, and he does face procedural barriers to be able to return, to be able to get rid of that aggravated felony charge. That we don't know if he's going to be able to do that.
So, and what's the length of time to file that motion?
I'm not sure the exact time, although I know it is long past for him. It's possible to request the judge to respond.
Okay, so they have the discretion.
Mm-hmm. If I may, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
You have 2 minutes and 30 seconds.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Leah Darren with the Attorney General's Office for the respondent in this case. I'd like to go to the issue Justice Koontz raised at the outset of the argument, and that is the defendant's current status. And we do know from the record, because Mr. Zemeni has put it into the record, that he is a derivative political asylee of Ethiopia. And there has been a determination made by an immigration judge that he will not be deported. He has been awarded withholding of removal. He is not in custody, and he is living at home.
For the time being.
Well, Your Honor, it's with all due respect, it's our position that just like creative plea bargaining and the possibility of a better plea agreement, that this kind of liberty deprivation is an inadequate basis for a finding of prejudice under the Strickland Hill analysis.
So for the rest of his life, he's essentially been in America legally for most of his life. For the rest of his life, he has to open up the newspaper every morning to determine whether there's a new regime in Ethiopia.
Well, or he can open up the newspaper and find out that ISIS changed their rules and he's no longer deportable. He is no more under a restraint than someone who's required to report as a sex offender. If someone, because of their offense, is required to report as a sex offender on the sex offender registry, and all of the hoops that person has to jump through, and that is not that's not something that this court would be something that is cognizable on habeas, since certainly some speculative future potential deportment to a country where we're not deporting people who are here under derivative political asylum status is inadequate.
I thought the specifics of his status was that he is subject to being deported to another country, basically at the whim of ICE.
Well, the bottom line is countries don't take defendants, individuals convicted of crimes. So other countries won't take him.
So you're saying that while there is a practical order out there that he could be deported, because no one will take him, he is not eligible for habeas.
If for some reason he had been convicted of murder, and he for some reason had been granted release for some reason, maybe a medical reason or something, he would not. He is, because of his status as a political asylee from Ethiopia, he would be awarded withholding from removal, and he would be free to walk the streets.
But there seems to me to be a distinction between a sex offender who has it within his or her control. As long as I continue to register, then I have I'm not exposed to being picked up and having my time revoked. But the difference here is that this individual has no control over whether some country might say, sure, send me your criminals and I'll take them all. He has no control over that. And so I don't see that as being an apt analogy.
Well, all I can say is it's a practical matter that just doesn't happen, Your Honor. And I think that there's Justice Moon's referred to online information available to the defendant about the sentencing habits of various judges. This kind of immigration information is readily available online. And speaking to Justice Mann's...
With the fact that it is readily available online, if there was an evidentiary hearing, and if it were shown that for all of the defendants in Fairfax who go to trial on petty larceny, none of them receive 365-day sentences, would that show prejudice for Strickland?
I would say no. I would say that would be a factor that the court could consider in a habeas where the defendant, were we back in the habeas trial court, and the defendant certainly had that information available to him and didn't choose to put it on. But nevertheless, that would simply be a factor to consider. And what we've argued on brief is that the defendant can't simply say, I would have gone to trial and asked for one less day, and I only sold $33 of beer.
Granted, but we're here without a full record. This was on a motion to dismiss.
I beg your pardon?
We are here without a full record from the habeas court because this was on a motion to dismiss.
Well, Your Honor, with all due respect, in Yates versus Murray, this court recognized that in habeas cases, the trial courts are encouraged to because they're collateral proceedings attacking an otherwise valid state court judgment. The trial courts are encouraged to employ simplifying measures if it's unnecessary, and this defendant had the ability to put on this kind of evidence, as he put on his own affidavit, as he put on his affidavit for the immigration judge about his political asylee status. He had the ability to say, no judge.
He did not have an evidentiary hearing. That's the bottom line.
Well, that's absolutely true, but that doesn't change the calculation in this case, because the habeas trial judge determined that he was able to make a decision in this case based on the existing record. The defendant was not precluded from proffering to the court the very evidence that you're referring
counsel,
to.
Help me on your argument. He had ineffective counsel. So if he had ineffective counsel, how is he supposed to do all these other things that we're talking about he had an opportunity to do?
Well, what we're talking about, Justice King, is his ability, because he was represented by counsel in the habeas trial court, he had the opportunity, as he put on his own affidavit, as he proffered to the court about his immigration status, as he had the ability to proffer to the court that, if it's true, that nobody who goes to trial on a petty larceny charge in Fairfax gets the full 365 days. He had the ability to proffer that for the court to take into consideration, and he didn't do it.
Counsel, what's the harm to the Commonwealth from an evidentiary hearing?
Well, for one thing, I go back to the court's analysis in Yates, its court's own statements in Yates, that this is a collateral proceeding.
We want them to be done efficiently. We want them to move through the system because there's not that many of them that have merit. But sometimes there are ones that have merit, and that's why the rules permit an evidentiary hearing.
They absolutely do. It was within the court's discretion. But in this particular case, the defendant proffered nothing but his own self-serving statements that he would have insisted on going to trial, and all he's asking for is one day less of a sentence, without regard to the facts of his case and to the circumstances surrounding his offense, which, by the way, the circuit court took into consideration when deciding, first of all, that his naked allegation without factual support was inadequate. But even looking at the facts of this case, the court found that it was highly unlikely that the defendant, had he gone to trial, would have been acquitted or found guilty of some lesser offense, which Zamani hasn't argued there was a lesser included offense, and there is no lesser included offense of petty larceny. So acquittal, so there's no reasonable likelihood that he would have been found not guilty, and there's no reasonable likelihood of a different sentencing outcome. The habeas trial court found that first of all, that Zamani's counsel hadn't proffered any information from the prosecutor that he would have been willing to go to the judge on less than a guilty plea on grand larceny with 365 days off suspended.
But as Justice Coates pointed out, he didn't. His calculus may not have been, what's the best deal can I get? He couldn't have gotten any worse if he had gone to trial.
Well, again, it goes to the finding of a different, what I'm driving at now is a different outcome with regard to the sentence. And in this particular case, the face of the warrant on page 12 of the record shows that this man, because he had multiple priors, was ineligible for alternative sentencing under the Fairfax County rules. The facts of this case show that this young man wasn't stealing diapers from the grocery store. He was stealing beer. He was stealing beer.
You reckon that makes a difference?
And I beg your pardon?
Does it make a difference
whether he's stealing diapers instead of beers? This was a recreational, this was a want, not a need. It was
He probably didn't need a diaper.
Well, his baby did, so maybe.
Can I ask you a different question, Russell?
Rephrase that. But at any rate,
Counsel, can I interrupt you and ask you a different question?
Yes, Your Honor.
You're kind of getting bogged down with it. Can you talk about the assignment of error? What did the trial court, the assignment of error says the circuit court erred by utilizing an inappropriate standard to determine whether or not the prejudice prong was met in the context of a plea agreement. This trial judge wrote about a 7-page order and talked about a whole lot of things. Did he use an inappropriate standard or not?
We've argued that he did not use an inappropriate standard, but our point on the assignment of error is simply that the assignment of error requires the defendant to put his finger on the error. And so the assignment of error simply says the circuit court erred by applying the wrong legal standard when determining that Mr. Zamani had met Strickland's prejudice prong within the context of a guilty plea. It doesn't fairly encompass the court's myriad of alternative factual findings. And the court certainly applied the Strickland-Hill test. And so Our position is, number one, the court applies the correct standard, but number two, the assignment of error simply doesn't fairly encompass the myriad of arguments that opposing counsel has made on brief and to this court this morning.
In Laster, so, didn't we talk about a plea agreement a little bit? And we talked about, you have to go a little bit further than just saying, I would have rejected the plea agreement and gone to trial.
Yes, I think in Ibarra, and the dissent on Ibarra, I believe it talks about this concept as simply the possibility of some alternative, creative plea bargaining or negotiating a different plea is inadequate of itself to demonstrate Strickland prejudice. Primo, the United States Supreme Court in Primo, which is cited in our brief, that case stands for that proposition. So the defendant's naked argument that all I'm asking for is one day.
They could have done worse. That's basically his argument. Could have done worse.
Asking for one day is simply inadequate. There has to be. You cannot reach the prejudice prong with regard to. You cannot address the prejudice prong with regard to the reasonableness of a different sentencing outcome without looking at the facts of the case. And Hill versus Lockhart. States that the analysis or calculation requires an examination and a prediction of the likely outcome of trial, and you cannot do that without looking at the facts of the case and going back.
Counsel, I totally agree with you in the average habeas case that we see, but we're looking at each case and whether a reasonably objective defendant under the facts of this case. Is that the standard that we're applying? Would have opted to go to trial?
Yes.
And so if you have someone who has the possibility of being returned to their own company and put to death, yes, what does that person have to lose by not going to trial?
Well, in order to meet his burden under Strickland and Hill, he has to show a reasonable likelihood of a different sentencing outcome. And he cannot do that. He cannot meet that burden without looking at how the case would have played out had it gone to trial and sentencing.
But his proffer is, I would have gone before the judge and said, Judge, if you send me back to my country, they're going to kill me. If you give me 362 days, they're not. What rational judge would not have said, okay?
First of all, at this juncture, we know he's not going back. But second of all, the judge would...
For the time being.
Well, and that aspect of the case, as I've argued earlier, under it is simply so speculative, it's insufficient to warrant a finding of Strickland prejudice. But nevertheless, the court still would have had to look at the facts of the case. And in this case, we have a defendant who's already ineligible. He is not a Boy Scout. He is
If I remember the facts of the case, they gave him no jail time so that he could be out of jail for his 21st birthday party. Were those the facts of this case? So the court was willing to give him all suspended time so that he could be out of jail? Is that not this guy?
The court did not know that. That comes, this aspect of his birthday came up in the context of the defense attorney and the prosecutor
agreement.
Arguing the plea. So no, what the judge is aware of is that the prosecutor recommends that the defendant get 12 months, all suspended on one charge, and we're going to null cross the other charges that the defendant is facing. So had he gone to trial, he would have gone to trial on this offense along with two others carrying two additional year-long sentences. And in this particular case, what we know about this case is that he's got priors. He's not eligible for alternative sentencing. The court, the Hayes trial court...
They're all misdemeanors, are they not?
They are all misdemeanors.
None of them involved violence, did they?
Yes, they did. In fact, this case shows the habeas trial court found aggravating circumstances surrounding this case. First of all, when the offense is reported, the defendant is physically fighting with the grocery store security officer. When the police arrive on the scene, the defendant is verbally abusive to the police officers. He appears to be under the influence of drugs and alcohol. He's arrested, and he would have been what they call live scanned and released, but he's being so belligerent at the jail, continuing to be belligerent at the jail, that they have to retain him.
He did not face charges for violent misdemeanors, did he? I know the facts just as well as you do. I don't believe that there was that he has been charged with assault, has he?
I believe there is. There certainly is a criminal history of prior drug charges. That's in the police report. Your Honor, with all due respect, this is a decision. That was a decision. Unless this court is going to say it's a matter of law, that is a defining that he had not been that he had never been charged with a violent offense. Unless the court's going to say as a matter of law that triggers the prejudice prong, then the court has to fall back on what did the habeas trial court find. And in this particular case, the defendant, again, was not...
Your time has expired.
Thank you very much. I apologize.
No, you're going to answer the court's questions. That's what you're supposed to do.
We ask that the... trial judge's decision be affirmed. Thank you so much.
Rebuttal. 2 minutes and 30 seconds left.
Counsel, show me in the court's order where it takes the position he would have shown that he would have been acquitted. You're saying that's the wrong standard that the trial court used?
Yes.
Where in his multi-page opinion does he
So
say?
On the joint appendix on page 110, it says, petitioner's self-serving statement is unaccompanied by any claim of innocence or articulation of any plausible defense he could have raised had he gone to trial. It also says at the bottom of that page, petitioner also fails to demonstrate prejudice because he has offered no evidence to show that had he gone to trial, he would have been found not guilty of the larceny or that the Commonwealth's attorney would have asked for anything less than a 12-month sentence.
Right. So the court goes on to say that there is no evidence that the Commonwealth would have asked for a lesser sentence or that the court would have honored that request or awarded a lesser sentence. So it's not just that the trial court says he has to have been acquitted.
No, but let me ask you, look at this. Look at page 111, the first full paragraph.
Yes.
Petitioner's failed to show a substantial likelihood of a different result had he gone to trial and so forth.
Yes, that is exactly the issue here. And that case that they cite is Richter, which is the standard by the Supreme Court, if one has gone to trial and is then alleging prejudice after the trial, that something a different result would have happened at the trial. In Primo, they talk specifically about a different result of the outcome of the plea bargain. Those cases were released on the same day, indicating a different analysis depending on whether someone's pled guilty or whether they've gone to trial. The other point that I'd like to address briefly with regard to his withholding, in addition to the deportation, he's under restraint. He cannot leave the state of Virginia for more than 48 hours without permission. He cannot leave the United States. He also has lost his lawful permanent residency status, which carries many benefits, including the ability to bring family here, to potentially become a U.S. citizen at some point. He's not able to do any of those things, nor is he able to adjust to a different status with withholding. So this is only a temporary protection because of the circumstances that he faces at this time. And that's an individualized finding based on him. Not all political asylees would necessarily face that. That's looking at circumstances.
Before your time expires, five out of the seven people who are sitting on this bench have sat on the General District Court in Virginia. What you're asking us to do, and I'm not saying that it's illegitimate, I'm just trying to crystallize it, is a suspended sentence, we understand, is for the purpose of controlling future behavior. For the most part, that's what it is. You're asking us to make the determination that a reasonable district court judge, general district court judge, even with a jury verdict of 365 days, if presented with the circumstances that might result in this man's death if he's returned to Ethiopia, that judge would have shaved one day off of the offense at sentencing so that possibility would not occur. And that's what you're asking us to do. I just want to make it clear. I mean, I'm not saying that's wrong that you're asking, but that's what you're asking us to determine.
Well, what I'm saying is that that's reasonably probable, that had his attorney brought that to the judge's attention, it's certainly reasonably probable that that would have happened. It's maybe it wouldn't have happened, but he deserved his attorney to effectively advocate for him as a non-citizen.
Right, so then the next question is, which has been asked before, is do we decide that, or do we remand it so that a judge at the circuit court level decides that?
We believe there's enough information here because of the objective circumstances that are so compelling in these kinds of cases that there's no evidence that he would ever rationally reject this plea. But if you would like more evidence or you think that's
appropriate. That's why I asked the question the way I did. I don't think that's ultimately the issue in this case. The issue in this case is if he got the worst outcome again, is it reasonably likely that a general district court judge in the Commonwealth of Virginia, faced with the understanding that a man might actually face death on deportation, that he wouldn't shave off one day?
I think that is certainly reasonably probable, especially given the leniency that we saw here with an entirely suspended sentence, that he would have been willing to shave off one day or give him a little bit of jail time in exchange for shaving off one day.
All right. Thank you. Your time is expired.
Thank you.
Call the next case.